Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
It's good to be here today, and I hope that we can answer as many questions, at least the essential ones that you may have. It's a big day. For the diocese and also for all of the people of Western New York, because we understand that the decisions that we make going forward impact on the lives of so many, most particularly our survivors, but also everybody that works and understands the mission of the church to really be the presence of God's love in our community in every way possible. Obviously, the big question that we have right here is that in order for there to be love and all of that, there has to be justice. There has to be a sense that we're doing things right and that we're doing things fairly and that we're doing them in a transparent manner. And I know there's been a lot of pain created by what are perceived, and I think rightly so in many cases, of being ways of doing things that we can't continue to do in the future. So I see this day as an opportunity for us, I won't use the word reset, but I will say for us to really focus on what our mission is so that we can purify it and do it better, and to do it in a way that is collaborative and that is open and that is transparent. Of course, the proceeding, the Chapter 11 proceeding, I'm careful not to use the word bankruptcy, even though we are in a bankruptcy court, because a lot of people are of the impression maybe that the diocese is running out of money, we can't meet our obligations to our employees, which is not true. But we want to do it in a way that is fair and open. So the hearing this morning went very, very well. I was very pleased with it. We realize we're just at the first stage of a long process. And I know there's a lot of questions that, for example, does this affect parishes and Catholic charities and other, and it does not. This is basically a diocesan action, and it's, as I say, it's Chapter 11 reorganization, and it's a way in which we're going to try to meet the needs and rightful demands even of our creditors. Now, I know that there are many who see this as something, because it does, as you know, cease the legislation and the discovery process of the CVA. But as you're probably well aware, that a lot of times when we go through the legal process, it's those that come forward first that get the biggest amount in the settlements. We want to do this in a way that is fair so that all of those who are entitled to some form of restorative justice or restitution, if we want to use that word, we'll be able to get a fair share of that. And I'm confident that through this process, as it unfolds, I'm very, very aware that words are easy to say and it's actions that count. So my hope is that going forward, regardless of the mistakes we have made, regardless of the suspicions that may rightfully have been raised about the way things were done, that going forward, we're going to see a lot of action that will result in very fair resolutions as much as we can. I've said this right from the start, though, and this is something that is, to me, is essential to the mission of the diocese. I do not see victim survivors of sexual abuse as people who we give settlements to. And one of the things that always galls me is when I hear the word package. You know, here's your financial settlement, be happy, go away. I do not want survivors to go away. I want to walk with them. I want to be with them, and I want them to know that they are an essential part, if they wish to be. You know, anger is obviously a big part of the process of healing. And, you know, I've used the the analogy of family many times, and it's because I really mean it. Isn't that a stunt? Isn't that something I just say because it sounds good? I really consider every single person, including our priests who may have abused people, as part of our family that I'm responsible to take care of in some way, even though I realize that they have to be disciplined and in some cases isolated. I also believe that every person, particularly those who suffer in silence, should not be afraid to come forward. And fortunately, the CVA is one way in which that was able to happen, that some people could come forward that for many years did not. But I also think that in the interest of trying to be able to reach out to everyone, that the process that we're undergoing right now through Chapter 11 will actually open up the doors to many more. That having been said, this is not a criminal process, you know, the CVA. And the diocese itself does have a process by which anybody coming forward, even if the criminal statute of limitation is in effect, can still come forward and present a case to the diocese. And we will look into every case. There's a canonical process as well, too. But more of that, you know, later. I don't want to get into the details. The point is that today I'm very, very happy that we've taken this step. And I really look forward, going forward, to be able to open up the doors, to open up the opportunities to better purify our mission going forward, and to ensure that all of those who need to be assured that we're walking with them in faith, and will be able to receive that justice, that restorative justice that they seek. So I'd be very happy. This is, you know, there's a lot of questions you may have. To answer any questions that you may pose to me or to my advisors.
I'm sorry, did you just say that the abusive priests are part of the family, as you call it?
That's correct. I believe.
Why would a survivor want to be a part of a family where the founder figure of the family invites child molesters to be part of the family?
All right, well, first of all, Charlie, I assume you're referring to what happened last Monday, because I'm not inviting child molesters to insult or to, and what happened in that gathering, I'm very sorry about, because I have no way of controlling the individual behavior of an abusive priest. But the purpose of last Monday's meeting was in order to be able to inform all of the clergy, including the charter priests. Now, not all of those, I use the term charter priests, not all of those charter priests, I don't know that there was anybody there that's been convicted criminally. You know, I don't know that, and to the best of my knowledge, not. There are some priests that were there that are on administrative leave because their cases are still in process. There were some, I think there were about five or six in total, whom credible accusations have been filed, you know. So I did not exclude them from that gathering, but I did not intend it as a public gathering in which I wanted in any way any victims to be offended. There also happened to be a priest there who was himself a survivor of sexual abuse. I think there may have been more than one even. And of course, going forward, we're going to have to be sure that incidents like that don't happen again. But the purpose was to gather the priests together, all of them, even the bad ones or the ones that are under suspicion, and to be able to give them information that everybody really needs going forward, because we knew that we were going to make this filing on Friday. So I wanted to be sure everybody had that information. And it was also an occasion, and this is something that bishops do. Bishops have a special relationship with all of their clergy. We call it the presbyterate. And that includes everyone. You know, if you isolate somebody or make them a pariah, and people that work in social services know this, you may actually be more in danger of inducing something like that, somebody like that, to act out. So I want to keep strong supervision of all of the priests, particularly those that have had challenges, not just in the areas of sexual abuse, but other areas, drugs, alcohol, and so forth. So I don't exclude them. But this was a gathering of priests, and it was very, very carefully planned as a private gathering, that this was not intended to be publicized, not because I'm not interested in transparency, but precisely because I did not want to trigger the victims who might see something like this and be hurt by it, as unfortunately some were, which I deeply regret. It's something that we do together. We celebrate Mass. You know, I think the idea that the Mass is a reward for virtuous behavior, you know, this is a church of sinners. As far as that man on the cross, there's not a person that I know that he didn't die for. including the way I go into prisons and celebrate Mass with people who are rapists and murderers. You know, Jesus was crucified between two criminals. So, you know, it's the fact that we come together and pray, and the entire theme of the Mass was to pray for us in our sinfulness. You know, one of the things I referenced was, and I hope, you know, I don't want to take up too much time on this issue because I want to focus on what we did today, and this will be the last I'll say of it for now. But, you know, when Pope Francis first became Pope, one of these things I asked him is, how do you define yourself, you know, as a human being, as Jorge Bergoglio? And when he said, you know, the one thing I know I can definitely say about myself is that I am a sinner. You know, I felt so good when he said that because I can identify with that. So see it as an opportunity for sinners to come together and to pray for those we may have hurt and to pray for one another. Now, I don't want to delay on this because what we did today, I think, has to really be the focus here. And because this is a path forward to healing and to restorative justice and to purification. And so I'll entertain any other questions as well, too. Yes, Jay. Right.
Cases. And many survivors and abusers have said that that action, not being able to enter into discovery, posing witnesses, doing records and such, is harmful, and that is one of the primary reasons they pursue the CBA case, not the money. What can you do to ensure that that documentation
Well, ultimately it does, because what happens is now what started in a state court now gets transferred into a federal court. And in the process of looking at the claims of those who might have filed, you know, this through the CVA, or those who might come forward before the bar date, which has not been set yet. In other words, all of those claims, whether they've already been filed in civil court or whether or not they've yet to be done, can eventually come forward. And in the process of trying to assess their validity and how they can possibly be compensated for, this will all be handled by the federal judge.
My understanding, though, is that discovery is much more than in a bankruptcy proceeding.
Right.
I can do this.
Okay, I'm going to, my attorney just said he can answer that for you.
Actually, discovery in a federal proceeding oftentimes can be broader than state court. So the issues in regard to discovery will be addressed in the federal court, but to answer your question, the discovery sometimes can be broader than in state court. The filing of the case simply stays and stops the state court litigation, but effectively those issues will be transferred to the federal bankruptcy court, and we will address those issues as the process proceeds.
Can you clarify an issue that came up this morning in the court regarding payment to the retired priests, and that the ones that have been removed, are they still being paid? Can you clarify that so that people in general know where that money is going?
Sure. The during the court proceeding, there was an issue which was raised prior to the time that we appeared, dealing with priests that have substantiated allegations against them. The motion that we filed today is to ensure ordinary course operation, continue to pay obligations as they come due, in order to get into the Chapter 11 in a seamless fashion. To the extent that there is a claim owed to a clergy on the substantiated abuse list, which is on the website, to the extent that there were any funds owed to them as of today, so that would be due prior to the filing, those will not be paid. That is the only thing that happened today.
But they'll be paid eventually, won't they?
Correct. Yeah. That's correct.
Bishop, as you go through this process here, I guess I'm curious, how long do you anticipate you staying in this role, going through this process of bankruptcy? Have you been given any indication as to how long?
I have no idea. I really don't. You know, I mean, I've been asked that question before. Naturally, I'm interested in the answer to that question, too, but I really don't know. You know, all I can say is people have been wonderful, both in my diocese and here in Buffalo. So I'm willing to do whatever the Holy See wants me to do for as long as I can be effective. But I really have no way of, I couldn't even speculate and say it'd be weeks or months or forever or never. You know, it could be any of those things. They may call me out tomorrow. They may say stay another month, 2 months, 3 months. I have no way of knowing. There's no, I'm getting no hints. Yeah.
What's your message to the individual parishes, including those that have schools that may be concerned about their own financial health?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And I can be very clear on this, that this is purely a diocesan matter at this point. You know, now if the parish individually, you know, decides to enter into a bankruptcy operation because of the challenge they're facing. But as you know, and I've said this before, and I don't want to, you know, to assume that you're not aware, but New York State's legal system is very different, for example, from Massachusetts, where the bishop roughly owns everything. And any time the bishop is sued or the diocese is sued, it means that everybody, you know, in the litigation can have access to all of the parishes. That is not true in New York State, where it's a corporation in fee simple is the technical term. Parishes are, I guess the best way to say it is separate, you know, corporations that have their own trustees, their own protections. So they would not be, they're not involved in this particular proceeding. So my message to the parishes, it would be, and stay calm. You know, this is not, there's not going to be any upsetment. If anything, and I said this to the employees a few minutes ago, because we're streamlining more now in our operations here in Diocesan Central, if anything, the services that we deliver to parishes should even be better or more improved, because that's the whole reason that the diocesan offices exist, is to serve and to support the parishes. And I'm saying that very publicly. If anybody in parishes has any concerns or fears, you know, please, we're here to help. And we're, the health of the diocese is in the health of its parishes. So, and the same with Catholic Charities as well, too, and other affiliated agencies. They are not involved in this. Okay, Jay, I want to give, go ahead. Yeah.
To follow up on that,
yeah.
There are parishes, schools, and other Catholic entities that are actually named as defendants.
Right. Right.
Alongside.
Right. Right.
Can you elaborate?
Yeah.
How do you go about protecting those?
Right. Okay. I'm going to defer to legal counsel here. Yeah.
It's an excellent question.
Yeah. Good question.
If
yeah.
you were in court today, you would have heard, I think you all know this, the only entity that has filed a Chapter 11 is the diocese, right? So the parishes have not filed. Any other non-diocesan Catholic entities have not filed. So your question's a good one, because I just said the filing will stop lawsuits against the diocese. What will happen is that during the Chapter 11, we will secure either an agreement to have the actions against the parishes stayed as well, in order to allow the opportunity to explore the creation of a trust for the plaintiffs. And we have been successful in other diocesan cases in doing that. But there's also an ability to go to the bankruptcy judge and specifically ask that the non-diocesan entities be protected. So I cannot tell you today, because you're right, there's no stay that stops an action against the parish today. But in the near future, we believe we will either have an agreement or we will seek that authority from the court.
Bishop, we heard today there are about 400 potential CBA plaintiffs, which means well more than 100 who would not yet have filed. What should this move say to them, or what should they, in your view?
Please come forward and take advantage of this opportunity in order to come forward, because I don't want anybody to be frozen out, you know, either of a civil process, you know, this is a different civil process, but it's still a process that is meant to address the desires of those who wish to take advantage of this. And as I said, there's also a diocesan process as well, too, for those who may want to go through that as well.
If I could ask a follow-up.
Sure.
There are hundreds of thousands of Catholics, when they go to Mass this weekend, what they put into the collection, how does this affect that, if at all?
Well, I tell you, a lot of people do ask that question, and it's a good question, and it was a question I would ask, too, if I was a parishioner. But parish collections belong to put it in legal terms, to the parish corporation. And the diocese does not routinely or even extraordinarily take money from the parish collections. They belong to the parish. In fact, I think it would be actually illegal to do so. There is a process, and I'll use the canonical term, called the cathedraticum, which is an assessment that a bishop can make of the parishes of funds in order to support the diocese's services for parishes, but not for the purposes of doing settlements. In other words, I guess to say it in very clear terms, no money comes out of collections in order to resolve claims of any sort, whether it's for sexual abuse or some other form of claims against the diocese. So they are legally secure. Parish collections are.
Seeking clarification, the IRCP program is not, those were monies paid out prior to the filing, so they're not a part of the filing.
Correct.
So there were 106, I believe, that we think 400 approximately is the number we stated in court. That's 500 individuals who come forward and claim that they were sexually abused by the clergy. That's approaching Boston.
It's terrible.
Is there a question?
But what's the question?
How? I mean, the question that everybody's been asking, how is it possible that this has gone on this long, this thorough through the diocese for so many years before we understood the scope of it today?
I have the same question as you do. I would like to know why too, but I want to focus on what we can do now. I can't help going forward by ruminating and speculating as to why certain actions were not taken in years past. I don't think that's productive right now. Maybe we can get some investigators to do that. But what I want to do is do what can I do now. I want to heal the hurt where it is now and go forward. You know, and that's my perspective, because I want to do what is most constructive for the time that I have that I'm here. And I see this as a way right now of doing something. This is a significant event that we're doing today. And I think it would actually speed up the process, to be frank with you. It will also be able to address specifically those individuals who most are seeking that kind of recovery.
But if we're talking about forgiveness as the center, Christianity.
Yes.
How are parishioners supposed to digest this? Because they're being asked to forgive a series of events that happen within their diocese. About forgiving a diocese for this level of...
Those are not my words. I'm not asking people to forgive. If you're angry at that, be as angry as hell. I don't care. I understand that. But the point is that I'm in the business of trying to heal, and healing has to come, first of all, by telling the truth and by being willing to admit where the pain and the hurt is, by identifying that. And it takes time. And I use the term families because this is a family that's been hurt. And it hasn't been hurt by one person. This didn't happen because of one person. It's not going to be healed by one person. We have to do this together. Every family has situations like this, where there's somebody in the family, maybe there's even been abuse, because as you know, 80% of cases of sexual abuse happen in family by fathers, mothers, uncles, and yet we have to live with those people and somehow accompany them going forward. And forgiveness is part of the process, but so is the admission of the hurt. And you know, I can only go back to walking together, because I always see in the life of my Lord and Savior Jesus that that's exactly what he did. He went out to hurt people, that he did not cause their wounds, but he met them where they were, walked with them, and tried to give himself sacrificially as their presence. And that's the best I can do. I can only pledge myself and then invite everybody else to do that with people closest to them. We got to do it together.
Bishop Scharfenberger, you said that you want to help people now. One of the things you promised to do for victims, survivors, is to allow them to have access to the personnel files.
Yeah.
In September 2018, the diocese complied with the state subpoena and gave personnel files to the state attorney general's office, redacted all the names. Mr. Connors did this.
Yeah.
And yet when we talk to victims, they tell us that the victim assistance coordinator and the secretaries here that they talk to have been giving them the runaround and asking them why they need access to these files. Why can't the diocese just take these files that apply to these priests who abuse these people and put that file on a flash drive and send to the victim. Why are they making them come here into the diocese and making it so much harder for them emotionally?
Well, because not everybody, because we want to make sure that the people that have a right to those files and need to see that get it, and that they don't, they're not abused by others who may have other interests in using them. Because some of those files contain confidential information that we're legally unable to release, you know, social security numbers, and also in cases of medical records and HIPAA. So, no, what I ask, if a victim survivor, and again, I've heard people say this as well too, Charlie, you know, it galls me when I hear that, because I want my staff to be very, very open to victims that would request, whether they want to sit down, you know, with me or with somebody else. I will work with the victims wherever they want to meet, and I would not demand that they have to be necessarily in the diocesan office to do that. I will work with any victims if they want to see what's in their files, and it will help them in the process of healing. I'll find some way to do it. I can't do it in a diner, but if I can find some way where it can be done in a confidential way so that they can see them, they may need some support, you know, in looking through them, and then they might want to bring somebody with them. So I don't want to, again, just say the different ways in which this can be done, but I want to find ways in which that can be done. I'll do my best, you know, to make sure that that gets done, anybody that comes forward. So it grieves me to hear that anybody feels they've gotten the runaround, but we'll keep doing the best that we can.
Make sure we get everybody who's got a question.
Yeah, he's got one.
Well, again, you know, our goal, you know, $9 million this year, we did bring it back a little bit. And again, as I reiterated when we made that announcement, that the collection that goes in Catholic Charities and the Fund for the Faith are not part of the bankruptcy proceeding. The funds are protected. People can elect where they want their funds to go. Catholic Charities are Fund for the Faith. So again, that's the reality. That's how people interpret that, or whether there's suspicions that's not the case. I don't know how to allay those fears, but Catholic Charities has its own mission, it's its own corporation, and I can say that certainly whatever does transpire ultimately through the Chapter 11 proceedings will not begin to, in any way, whatever collections are done this year for this Catholic Charities collection, I can say with confidence, will be for allocated for the work that Catholic Charities does.
The last question I have is, critics of this announcement already are calling it self-serving and victim shaming. You're not protecting them, you're actually protecting yourself. What is your response to people who are?
Well, some will say that, but you know, the church exists for others. You know, our mission is precisely to spread the gospel, the good news of Christ's saving message. And, you know, one of the things I'm willing to do is give up everything for that mission, you know. So, again, words are very, very cheap at times, but I can always actions speak louder than words. And our primary mission is to be of service, not only to the Catholic population, but to all people, to all. And I hope that this will help us to focus more on that mission. And certainly, I want to be sure that every survivor, victim, whatever resources we have, we can give them to help them to find the support that they need. And as somebody said, many victim survivors are not primarily looking for financial settlements. They want to be listened to, taken seriously, accompanied in the faith, given that moral and spiritual support as well too, which is part of what we do.
Any
other questions? We're going to keep it. Yes, ma'am.
Can you explain the St. Joseph's Fund and what we heard in court today and from the past
of
what's been done with that?
I think that
explaining the St. Joseph's Fund is a little bit beyond today's scope. I'll give you a little outline. St. Joseph's Fund is a separate corporation. It's a not-for-profit entity. It is a vehicle by which investments are made by the diocese and other participants, parishes, and related, you know, other non-Catholic, excuse me, other Catholic non-diocesan entities. It is simply an investment vehicle. It is supervised by independent fund managers who make investment decisions. As I'm sure you can understand, if you pool your funds, you can at times receive a better return. But each of the funds that are in the St. Joseph's Fund are separate dollars. So if there are parish funds, those are separate parish dollars. There is a diocesan piece of that, which we talked about today.
Why did the diocese move $91 million out of their fund in 2006 on the child that comes out for St. Joseph's?
First of all, I don't know if that happened. What year?
Father, the late Monsignor William Gallagher was on the Finance Council at the time, and he has said that publicly.
Okay, that's fine. What year?
2006.
Okay, so I have no idea. Okay, it was 17 years ago, can't add, but whatever it was. So bottom line is I don't know that answer. Happy to try to answer that. But I don't know the circumstances of any alleged transfer well over 10 years ago.
I do have one more question. It's
Charlie, just before you got Chuck Mandelaro, who's the chief financial, do you want to clarify that?
Maybe I can shed a little bit of light on that. Back in 2006, the monies were held at the diocese and invested for the various entities, such as the parishes, cemeteries, foundation, different Catholic entities. That monies were never the diocesan money. They were always the funds of that particular entity. So all that happened back then was a decision was made to set up a separate legal corporation, the St. Joseph Fund, because they would have a better way of managing that money. We brought in managers throughout the whole country. We hired NEPC, New England Pension Consultants, to help consult and manage that so that there would be a better efficiency, a better return. We'd have a better way of diversifying and also investing the money in the Catholic teachings. So there was a broad range of things that this organization could do on its own that we couldn't do as a Catholic entity, because that was not our job. We were trying to help the parishes at the time invest their money because they had no vehicle to do that. So this made more sense to set it up separately so it could be handled more efficiently and provide a better return for the participants of the fund.
Okay. Actually, you mentioned that the parishes earlier are individual corporations, so to speak. But what about the other entities, such as, like, for example, Fatima Shrine in Lewiston? Are they their own corporation and protected?
I believe so. You know, that many are. It's not uncommon in New York State for this kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Christ King Seminary, of course, closed a few weeks ago. And while the diocese sourced through this, has it explored ways to continue seminary education?
Oh, absolutely. That's a number one priority of me and of every bishop, too, to make sure that our seminarians get the best education possible. And I don't know, this is beyond the scope of our right here, but I'd be happy to talk with you or anybody else about that, what our plans are. We actually have a steering committee going right now to make sure that our seminarians not only get a great theological education by going to other seminaries, which in some ways can also enrich the diocese because it brings a little more diversity because they have different experiences. We do that in Albany, but also to make sure that they get the type of pastoral formation, human formation, and spiritual formation that sometimes, quite frankly, seminaries can't do alone. So the process of promoting and growing vocations goes on, and we'll find even better ways of doing it.
Do I understand correctly that those that are retired clergy that have been credibly accused are no longer on the diocesan payroll, is it?
No,
I already answered that question.
Yeah.
Okay. Bishop, I'm sure you had some understanding of what Buffalo was like before you came here, but now that you've had a few months to kind of get used to what it is out here, is there a way that you can quantify how serious this situation is here in Buffalo, Western New York, for all the parishioners here?
I don't know if I can answer that question in a quantitative terms, because I have a person that, you know, I'm not a numbers guy, to be honest with you. I like person-to-person relationships, and I see a lot of fractured person relationships, lack of trust. I see there is anger, but I see there's also hurt, maybe even feelings of betrayal. And I'm sure that works on all sides as well, too. So, you know, and again, that's why I keep saying I do take seriously my mission as a father, as a pastor. And I can't do it alone. As I said, I'm particularly concerned, for example, about the people on the front lines, parish leaders, you know, not only clergy, but also lay leaders. And that's where people live, you know, where they raise their families. So what I try to do as best as I can is to strengthen those connections, you know. And, of course, we are a people that as Catholics, we're a sacramental church. So the importance of Mass, the importance of the sacraments, the importance of our prayerfulness, and obviously our structures. We have to have credible structures. What we did today, I see as a goal towards transparency, no hidden corners.
So I guess to word it maybe differently, how would you compare what it's like here in Buffalo to, say, in Albany?
Well, they're very different environments. I mean, I don't want to go off message here, but, you know, Albany is reminds me a little bit more like of my roots downstate in some ways. It is a government capital and so forth. What I see in Buffalo reminds me, has a Midwestern feel to it. You know, people tend to be, I think they wear their hearts, you know, on their, I'm not saying they don't do that in Albany, but I see this really like kind of less politicized, and a lot of people with strong ethnic roots, you know, they still identify with, whether it's Irish, German, Polish, Latino, or whatever. And, you know, we speak of Buffalo as a city of neighborhoods, a city of good neighbors, you know. And so I do have that sense. There is that warm, you know, personal sense, and although it's hurting, you know, I feel that strong pride. One of the reasons I think, if I may, I didn't want to speculate, but, you know, one of the reasons why there has been so much attention to what the church is doing, you know, by the media, which I'm grateful for, is because it matters. It matters to people what's going on in the church and how we are as church, you know? So that, you know, and that should challenge us. You know, there's an old expression we used to use after Vatican II for your Latinist, Ecclesia Semper Reformanda, the church must always be reformed. We can never sit where we are. We always have to be willing to make those changes necessary, painful though they are, so that we can purify our mission. And our primary mission is to people and to families and parishes.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.